This is Robert Morris University's Literature Out Loud, sponsored by Rune, the RMU literary magazine. I'm Dylan Sadoriak, managing editor of Rune. My guests today are Tess Berry and John Lawson. Tess Berry was shortlisted for the 2015 Manchester Poetry Prize, twice a finalist for the North American Review's James Hirst Poetry Prize and Aesthetica Magazine's Poetry Award. She was also shortlisted in 2018 and 2014 for the Bridgeport Poetry Prize. Her poems have been widely published in the U.S., U.K., Ireland, and Australia. Berry is a fellow of Western Pennsylvania Writing Project. She teaches at Carlow University, where she also works for the MFA in Creative Writing Program, and was a former teacher here at RMU. Welcome, Tess.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back.
John Lawson teaches writing and rhetoric here at Robert Morris. He's been writing poems and songs for more than 50 years, and he added playwriting to his repertoire about 40 years ago. His chapbook, called Generations, was published by St. Andrews University Press. Welcome, John.
Thank you. I'm here almost every day, so it feels pretty normal.
But great to be here with you, John.
It's great to have you both here. Today we're having the release of 2019 edition of Rune, and it's been an amazing time being the chief editor for that this year. Tess, you taught creative writing at RMU for several years, and you're back on campus today as a guest reader for our 2019 Rune release celebration. Would you start us off with a couple poems?
Sure. I've been thinking about the 2016 election as we gear up for the 2020 election. And this is a poem I wrote about the 2008 election of Barack Obama. I worked for the Obama campaign and specifically was out on election day in 2008, which really felt like a cultural shift in the United States. So this is a poem about something that happened to me that day. White Girl Sonnet for Barack Obama. I come from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, from Donegal, from Croatia, from Mont Saint-Michel, from Troy Hill, from a long line of immigrants, from steel mills, racists, and bigots, from the city of bridges, the Mon and Yauk rivers, from egalitarian blowhards, from an infant left in a basket in Dubrovnik, from the note attached to her blanket. We are opera singers and can't care for her. I come from a century's arias, from untraceable orphans, from Robert E. Lee and Honest Abe Lincoln, from American might and wrong-headedness, from white Catholic churches and mostly white neighborhoods, from the canonized privilege of dialect, from the syntax of Caucasian ignorance. And like a vine I can never eradicate, it creeps in between slats, cracks my pavement. Pull it up by its roots with both hands, turn away, and it creeps rifely back. On election day 2008, I worked the polls, signed an affidavit for a 92-year-old white woman. She was blind, you see. I had to enter the election box to witness as she cast maybe her last vote for democracy.
Thank you very much, Tess. That was lovely.
I read a lot about my family. I grew up in Pittsburgh. I'm one of 10 children. My mother is a remarkable person, someone who filled our home and our lives with art and literature. She's also very eccentric, and I write a lot of poems about her. This is a poem about my mother and the world she created for us. Girl in a Pasture. My mother imagined us in paintings. She filled her expensive prints and oil canvas portraits with photos of the lives we lived. Placed my brother James in Van Gogh's wheat fields. We're 12 years old, in baseball uniform. Jim holds a bat, awaits a pitch. The first five of her 10 children nestle together in olive trees among crows and wheat. four of her granddaughters in swirly Christmas dresses stare out from Surratt's Sunday afternoon on the island of La Grande Jatte. Passing down her cool hallway, I find myself standing behind the boys in Winslow Homer's pasture. They sit blithely, unaware of me. I am three, holding sunflowers and showing my belly.
Huh. That was Tess Berry's poem, Girl in a Pasture.
I guess it's my turn. I've brought only very new poems to write, to read. I've written everything I've got in front of me in the last 2 weeks, and so I'm never sure if they work. But I'm going to try them out on you guys.
They're fresh.
Yeah. And you're starting with a political poem actually made me think of this one I've got here, which is kind of allegorical for our current political impasses. It strikes me in our political discourse how siloed we are and how different realities we live in. Politically. I mean, we just don't acknowledge the same facts. I've often seen couples live like that too, where they reinforce each other's bubbles and sort of insulate each other against the world that the rest of us live in. So this is kind of combining those two ideas. It's called Clair de Lune. How long we sheltered in your bedroom to escape the rain we knew lashed the night beyond the windows, filled the streets and swirled in nightmare rivers, sweeping, churning, drowning all. Now a narrow beam between your blood-red drapes. The moon's been out there waiting all along.
Beautiful.
Thank you very much. That was wonderful.
That was great.
Thanks.
You gonna read us another one?
I would like that as well.
Okay. Here's a seasonal one. I go on long walks every day if I can, and I was enjoying the April coming on, so here we go. April. Last night was winter still. But now full sun calls up the crocuses, and down the block old Ray brings out his trowel to relay the ice-crumbled steps to his front stoop. Spring is simply here again as if she never left. But when you ask her where she's been, she turns that regal face away, pretends she doesn't hear you.
Lovely.
John, we've talked a little bit off air about some of the writers you admire. Would love to hear it for our people listening. Who inspires you? And both your poems kind of sensed a naturalist tone there.
Well, I'm in the room, writers? Actually, with one of the poets I admire greatly. Tess has been a great inspiration to me. And I went to undergrad school with a wonderful writer named Ron Bays, whose work I've sort of teethed on, and he was a devotee of Ezra Pound, which I didn't get. I mean, Pound was this fascist weirdo, and
smart and so difficult.
Yes, and his stuff was so opaque to an undergrad like me at the time that I just literally would read some of his poetic passages at parties to elicit laughter. but, you know, gradually the habit of trying to think what the heck he was up to there on the page challenged me enough that I kept at it and kept at it, and finally one day kind of went, boing, oh, I'm beginning to get it now. Uh-huh. And, you know, speaking
it's of... It's like reading James Joyce's Ulysses.
Well, exactly, yeah, let alone Finnegan's Wake. And, you know, actually Pound tried so many things that he's an endless well of inspiration for me because he just is all over the map, literally. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. I haven't got to Pound yet, but it's on the list. And Ulysses is sitting on my shelf. It's a large tackle there. Tess, would you like to share a couple poems? And then we can talk about some of your inspirations and how you started writing.
Sure. I have another mother poem. As I say, my mother has had a remarkable life. Not only been the mother of 10, but also a writer, a nurse, and a world traveler in her later years. This poem is about an experience that happened to her when she was growing up. She was always telling us stories about her growing up. She grew up in the north side of Pittsburgh in the Mexican War streets, and was actually a neighbor of Dan Rooney, who was a year ahead of her at St. Peter's. It's called Near the Ocean's Edge. The bus that took my mother to Atlantic City in 1945 was a Greyhound. She was 14, leaving home for the first time to visit Adeline and John Higgins, who used to live next door. They were childless and good to her. She traveled alone, a tiny, solitary thing. A drunken sailor sat down next to her and stared, then asked, "Can I suck a hickey on your neck?" She had no idea what he meant, moved seats and sat alone. Seeing the ocean for the first time, she wept. She couldn't swim, but walked the shore for hours. Near the ocean's edge, she first saw seahorses, a herd of them floating. They were beautiful and stationary, too magical to be living. She thought them shells, packed her suitcase full of them, laid them gently between her worn cotton dresses and under things. Arriving home, she opened her case to show her treasures to a friend, and they'd rotted, the stench so strong it dizzies her still.
That was my guest, Tess Berry, reading her poem, Near the Ocean's Edge.
Such powerful imagery. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Your mother seems like a remarkable woman and lived quite a life.
She has, and she's still with us. Though she had a stroke last year, we're grateful she's still with us. Yeah. She's been a real inspiration to me as a poet and a person.
She was a writer, you mentioned?
Yes, she wrote poetry. She actually wrote plays, too. For her entire life, an avid reader. We had a house that was overrun with books. Oh. And she was always taking us to the library. She never attempted to publish anything, but for about the last 15 years, ending last year when she had her stroke, once a week she would mail to her 10 children, to each of us, an envelope, and in that would be a poem. We would all get the same poem. And the subject matter would vary between nature, her life, poems about us, about our father who passed away many years ago. It's interesting to think about creating art as a means of sustaining the self and the spiritual self. And I think for her, that was part of it. There's also the world, the outward creation of art and the publication and the sale of art, and she was never really engaged with that, just the artistic side of it. So I'm very grateful for that as an example.
Yeah, I can imagine what a joy it would be to receive a poem from her.
Yeah, it was great, because you never knew what was coming. Mm-hmm. So I have a very large binder of poems of hers I've collected over the years and have hopes that someday I'll have an opportunity to publish them.
Wow.
Would you like to read us another one, Tess?
Sure. I write a lot of ekphrastic poems, and ekphrastic poems are poems that respond to art. So the most famous example might be Ode to a Grecian Urn. I think it's a term that can be expanded to include not just art, but literature and other forms of art. In this poem I wrote, there's a Picasso painting that I particularly love called Poor People on the Seashore. It's a mother and a father and a child. And it's a painting I always think about when I experience any kind of trauma or sadness. So I wrote this poem a couple of years ago when my nephew died tragically. finding my bearings in Picasso's Blue Period. When I am sad, I return to your Blue Period and rest there. I read and walk on blue sand, swim in melancholy, drown my longings in brushwork and white caps, press myself between your poor people on the seashore. I turn to your mother first, her arms crossed and head down, wrapped in the cape of herself, unified in blue monochrome. I give her some bread, which she takes, never looking into my eyes. She doesn't acknowledge me, doesn't even acknowledge your abrupt and smooth sea. I turn to your father, hold his elbows, offer him shelter. Back to the shore, he faces her, faces emptiness, faces me too, but our eyes never meet. Their young son faces them both, a force and a presence. One hand rests on his father's dark thigh, another floats free, grasps my offering. Arm in arm, we turn toward your blued sea, find our bearings in the thick, even strokes, in your constancy.
That was my guest, Tess Berry, reading her poem, Finding My Bearings in Picasso's Blue Period. I really enjoyed that one.
Oh, great. Thank you. I love Picasso. He's one of my life obsessions. Picasso and Einstein are two of my life obsessions.
Yeah. The creativity just exploded out of that guy constantly.
Yeah. And like Einstein, he was, until the very end of his life, very prolific in terms of, so he had a life with so many different stages in terms of the, one in terms of producing theory and thoughtful, kind of life-changing ideas about the mysteries of the universe, the other in producing just, you know, remarkable artwork that will live forever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He could see the bull in the bicycle handles.
Yeah, his paintings really move me. Yeah. Some of them are so emotional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So thank you very much. I'm so grateful to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you're welcome. Yeah. Love having you. Let me continue with the seasonal theme that I broached, and actually this one, I'm not sure, this ends with a trope that may be too familiar, so I'm curious to see whether you think it works. This is called May. And I probably should add that it was really inspired by Gene Toomer's book, Cain. Don't know if you know that, but African-American writer of the 20s, and he wrote these wonderful little sketches in prose sometimes and in poetry other times that were almost haiku-like in their intensity and impact. So this isn't reaching that level by any means, but this is called May. May is young and beautiful and filled with life. And even though the younger children snicker and her elders ask just where the hell she thinks the money's gonna come from with no man, she rests her slender arms across her belly, swelling like an ocean wave, a summer apple, watches all the women as they pass, casting sidelong glances.
That's so great.
Well,
I love the summer apple. What a great image.
Oh, good. The last couple lines, the women as they pass casting sidelong glances, plays on this trope of women having a special connection with fertility and, you know, the virtues of spring and childbearing and all that sort of thing. I'm not actually sure that's true.
I like the idea of it complicates the poem for me. So we see May, but we also see how she's being seen. So it complicates it for me in a way that I really like.
Interesting. I hadn't actually thought of
it. It makes
that.
It more complex.
Yeah.
And leaving it on that note makes me think about the poem more.
Good.
It leaves me thinking.
I, on the other hand, don't want to play too hard into the trope of women having that special relationship to parenthood, because although I was very late entering fatherhood, I was 44 when my only son was born, I feel every bit as connected to parenthood as a result of that child raising experience as I think women could conceivably be.
That's a lovely poem, John.
Thank you. So I told you that I'd walk every day when I can. I walk around my adopted hometown of Ambridge, which is great to walk in because it's got these very steep hills, and they're great for cardiovascular workout. But I'm distressed by litter, and so one of the things I do is on my walks, I pick up litter as I go, especially recyclable litter. And that, so I've gotten a number of poems out of my walking around Ambridge, and this is one. It's called Chicken John, which is a name that has grown in my mind for myself in my role as walker about Ambridge, and is reinforced every time I look in the mirror and see my neck looking more and more like a chicken's neck.
A rooster, John.
How kind of you to say. Chicken John. When Chicken John walks past our house every day, precisely 12:13 p.m., except in snow when he loses half a minute, he carries in his left hand a plastic grocery bag, half full of litter that he gathers as he walks. And when an airplane passes overhead, he cranes his head back, stares real hard until it reaches the horizon, as if he's making sure the neighborhood, the town, the state, the nation, and the world are safe, and every single move is counted.
That's great. I love it. And I love the story behind it. I'm obsessed with people who litter too, and it drives me crazy because I live in the city and people just throw things out of their car windows. Yeah. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah.
So I'm out there with the Southside groups and on our property in the Southside picking up litter and just appalled.
Yeah.
Totally appalled. Yeah, we need to bring back the old commercial with the Indian in the riverbed crying.
Yeah,
which was so impactful and I haven't seen for so many years. But there's definitely a litter issue in Pittsburgh.
Yep, it's interesting how those images stick with you.
Yeah, for sure.
I can really picture you after your story and then hearing you read that. It's quite funny.
I would do a whole series of this.
I've been attacked by dogs, and that's a major theme for
I'm sorry to hear that.
Tess, would you like to read us another one?
Sure. This is a poem that's in form. I grew up in a kind of rural neighborhood, and just next to our home was a field of apple trees, and it was a neighborhood that was rife with children. So there were, 20 or 30 houses and probably more than 40 children growing up at different times in that neighborhood, which was kind of great. And because we had a lot of space outside to play, but every fall when the apples would rot on the trees and fall, we would have these terrific apple fights, the girls versus the boys. So this poem came out of that. And I wrote it in form so that there's a pattern in terms of this number of syllables in each line, which forces a kind of rhythm on the poem. It's called Apple Wars. My battle-ready brother shook them down, though many lay already ripe and rotting on the ground. We sharpened twigs to apple-stabbing knives. Morning until night, we smelt of rot, of rottenness. Shucked them at each other hard and quick, whipping whittled battle sticks. Ran from tree to tree, girls versus boys, our hair, our skulls, our necks, sticky with rotten appleness. Calling a truce just once, when Robbie, bully from next door, got tripped, went face first into my sister's heap, got mad, picked up a brick, tossed it at her head, and she beat him senseless. Black and blue, the wounded were removed, called in for baths or dinner. One lone tire swing swayed free. I slipped inside its open rubber mouth, gaping at the aftermath of war. I thought of winter, summer, spring. Winter, summer, spring. Time halting in each creek.
Wow.
I'm so glad to hear your neighborhood had weird events like that.
Yes. Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah. It makes me sad that children today are so helicopter parented, for lack of a better word, and don't have the kind of freedom to roam. I mean, I think because I came from a big family, most of the children in my neighborhood came from families of 4, 5, 6, that our parents were anxious to get us out of the house and not to kind of be on top of us planning our every minute. And that allowed for some imagination and also some violence, which I think is a big part of childhood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The kids in my neighborhood used to have big rock battles. We'd actually be throwing rocks at each other.
Thank God we didn't do that. We had some serious rivalry. Somebody may have ended up dead. As you see in this poem, I had a sister who was very tough, who later became a nurse. And she was sort of
but it's funny,
the queen of the neighborhood.
I wonder when that helicopter parent phenomenon set in, because, you know, we were just set loose to roam. No big families in my neighborhood, you know, just, you know, 2 or 3 kids.
I think from what I've read, people speculate. Recently I was reading an article that the last generation to have a childhood was Generation X, which I'm part of. So I think people who came of age in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, before really the rise of technology, had a different experience. And I think as a result are much more capable of functioning maybe than the generation that's coming, because they've been so coddled.
Be careful, we got a couple of them in front of us.
Present company excluded. I know both of these. And look out world is all I can say.
Born in the late 90s, I didn't really have a childhood where we would run around and play with neighboring kids or anything too often. It just didn't happen.
Really?
And my parents weren't that overbearing either. So maybe I'm an anomaly, but I don't think I am from what I hear. I think it just depends on the specific neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, you probably have a few less scars as a result.
Exactly.
What about you, Malik?
I actually did. I grew up kind of – I was always the, like, person that was inside, but we grew up next to a foster family, so there were a lot of kids in our neighborhood, and we had a really big yard, so it wasn't uncommon for us to play till late at night, or at least till sundown.
Yeah, which was great, and we did that. We would be gone all day, summer, winter, spring, fall. We had kickball tournaments, which often resulted in fist fights, built forts, we had, for instance, a Tarzan swing. I have a poem about that. I don't have it with me. That we would hang from this very high tree on a hill, and it was actually on someone's property, and he would come and cut it down, and we'd come back and hang it up. Eventually, somebody fractured their skull on this swing. So there's helicopter parenting, and then there's the threat of danger, letting your children run wild. So I'm glad to hear you had some free time, though. I think that's good for your imagination and your growth.
I enjoyed how your poem showed both of those sides, too. The joy you felt from those experiences, but also kind of the danger and some of the violence that went on that.
And it's a precursor for adulthood, for human interaction, which can be wonderful, but also very dark and damaging, depending on the human.
And you got to be ready to throw them apples.
You got it. John, you gonna read another?
Why don't you finish this up with one?
I'm trying to decide here. I have a I'm going to read a, I'll read a kind of somber poem. I have a longer one, but this was one of my poems that was shortlisted for the Manchester Prize, as was Near the Ocean's Edge. It's a poem about my father's death. He died on Christmas Eve very suddenly when I was 19. And in the wake of that death, it was so profound to lose a parent. I was struck by how little we had in terms of material objects to represent his life, which had seemed so great and important and remains that certainly to us. It's called My Father's Remains. The moment he died, my father's remains grew small in size, shaped by our hands and fingers. The faint and lingering scent of tobacco rose from our paging his hymnals and pawing his coats. His wallet was frayed, its outer edges rawhide again from years of his palming. It held very little cash. We opened that wallet and found a fold-out tent stitched together in plastic rows of worn faces. It unfurled easily, and we fell down in steps. It held all 10 of us and our mother. We found the wallet in his small sock drawer, the socks all uniform, all black. I took them all, and he was laid to rest and borrowed.
That was very powerful. That was Tess Berry reading My Father's Remains.
Thank you so much, Dylan. Thank you, Malik. Thank you to the wonderful, talented John Lawson,
my
friend and a poet I admire.
Tess Berry.
Thank you to my guests today, Tess Berry and John Lawson. This has been Literature Out Loud, sponsored by Rune and RMU Radio. I'm Dylan Stroyak. Thank you for listening.
Great.